In the coming week, India struggles with the world's most severe COVID-19 surge. The Somalian president addresses parliament amid a political crisis, and the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan gets underway 10 years after the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. It's April 29th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, after achieving some success in its initial efforts to contain COVID-19, India is now registering the largest number of cases worldwide. Just this past week, India passed 200,000 COVID deaths. That makes it the fourth country in the world to do so. By some accounts, the number of deaths is actually greatly underreported. So initial reports are now saying that hospitals are short on beds and oxygen. Funeral homes and crematoriums are overwhelmed. Jim, tell us what's going on in the world's second most populous country.
Bob, India is dealing with a tremendous surge in COVID cases, as you point out. The situation is horrific. As you note, we've seen mass cremations. If people are on Twitter, they no doubt have seen tweets that have been forwarded by others asking for leads on things like how to obtain oxygen for ill people, for medicines, for hospitals to go to. Again, as you point out, the numbers are staggering. We're running now more than 300,000 new cases in India over the past week. The average daily death rate is topping 3,000. Just to put that in comparison, the United States is averaging right now about 63,000 new cases every day and about 700 or so deaths. And as you pointed out, the Indian numbers almost certainly are greatly understated. And of course, when you're talking about India, you're talking about a country that doesn't have the kind of robust healthcare system that the United States does. And I think it's safe to say that in many parts of India, its health services have been overwhelmed. Again, the surge caught many people by surprise, certainly caught the Indian government by surprise. If you look back in the fall, there was a lot of talk about how India was seemingly defying the trends we were seeing elsewhere in the world because a surge didn't materialize. There was a lot of talk about why India might have been the exception, involving speculation about India's climate or its relative youth or perhaps a natural immunity among the population. And Indians were so optimistic that in February, the Indian parliament passed a resolution stating, let me quote it here, "It can be said with pride, India defeated COVID-19 under the able, sensible, committed, and visionary leadership of Prime Minister Modi." With that great optimism and having declared victory, India opened up. A lot of it was driven by a desire by the Modi government to win crucial state elections. They staged mass election rallies, and they continued with them even as the numbers surged. Major religious celebrations that brought millions of Indians together were allowed to proceed. And what has really angered many Indians is that the Indian government made no effort to prepare itself for a surge, no effort to build up medical supplies, especially of oxygen. And even though India is the world's largest manufacturer of vaccines of all sorts, the Indian government doesn't look to have upped the production of COVID vaccines or moved quickly to approve foreign vaccines. Indeed, it even began sending a good portion of the COVID vaccines it could produce to other countries. Now, that was partly for humanitarian reasons, but it was also partly because the Modi government wanted to compete with China's vaccine diplomacy. That's now ended. India is no longer sending vaccine abroad. Now, the surge obviously has rocked India beyond the obvious humanitarian costs. It's delivered a major blow to the Indian economy. It is likely to contract, and it's going to be very interesting to watch what the political ramifications are going to be. As I mentioned, India on the state level is having several upcoming elections. Modi is getting a lot of blame, but the Modi government is not sitting idly by. It's been attacking its critics, leading to great concerns about the erosion of Indian democracy. The Indian government, among other things this week, ordered Twitter to remove posts critical of its handling of the pandemic. Again, this has led many Indians to worry that the authoritarian turn that the Modi government is taking is only going to intensify.
Jim, we're seeing a number of things play out here that have a familiar ring to it, certainly to Americans, in terms of a sense of, well, you know, the virus may be rough over there, but it's not going to hit us over here. I think there's also this sense of we need to give people some sense of life getting back to normal. And, you know, whether it's the political rallies, whether it's religious festivals, that is all very sort of part of human nature. Then you add to that kind of a populist government, previous U.S. administration, certainly that to some extent. You could say the same about a few U.S. governors, perhaps. And you add that into the mix, and it just seems like with the combination of these variants, and I haven't seen anything about the types of variants, whether it's a single one or where it's multiple ones has hit India. But it seems like this sort of storm of multiple fronts has come together into India, and you mix in a bit of hubris and you've got a really bad situation.
Certainly, Bob. And I think one of the big questions that scientists are looking at and hoping to answer is what actually drove the surge? How much of it was due to India reopening and the virus taking hold? And how much is it that variants have emerged that are more transmissible or perhaps more deadly? And again, scientists are doing that sort of research. It does raise the big question that affects not just India, but all other countries as well. Are we seeing the emergence of variants that might defeat existing vaccines, or put it somewhat differently, that existing vaccines may be less effective at curtailing? And that raises questions of whether new vaccines or variations on existing vaccines can be produced quickly to deal with that. And I think the broader picture here is that it points to the fact that COVID-19 is not a problem that individual countries can defeat. It is going to take essentially a global effort, and I think it's going to take a long time to do it, to try to contain the virus. We may never, ever totally eliminate it. There's the potential for it to be endemic. There's the potential for new variations to come up. That's why there's sometimes talk about how in the United States and other countries, you're going to have to get an annual booster shot, much like you get an annual flu shot, to try to tamp it down. But it is a big problem right now in India. And the really terrifying thing about it is not clear that India is going to be able to turn the situation around quickly. I will note a number of countries are sending supplies, vaccine and the rest to India. But again, the need is tremendous. And of course, there's some anger in India over what they see as relatively slow response by other countries, particularly the United States.
And I believe there were some contacts this past week between Biden and Modi. The U.S. made this big announcement about freeing up something like 60 million plus doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, a lot of which is assumed to be heading towards India's way, as well as some moves maybe on the supply chain front to ease up that. But are we looking at any sort of bigger moves potentially, Jim, like easing up on patent controls for the U.S. vaccines? India has this tremendous capacity to produce vaccines. Maybe that's a way out of this abyss.
Well, we haven't seen moves to lift patent protections so far. And my sense is that the companies that have developed these vaccines do not wish to do so. That doesn't mean that they haven't entered into all kinds of arrangements to allow for production. And again, in the India case, in terms of vaccines that were developed abroad, part of the problem, again, is the Indian government hasn't cleared the use of those vaccines. And I will note, even with the U.S. offer that you mentioned, as I understand it, the AstraZeneca vaccine, which has not been cleared for use in the United States, will not be provided to India or other countries until it passes some further scientific review here in the States. I'm not sure how long that will take. But obviously, you're in a situation globally in which the demand for vaccine is much, much higher than the existing supply. Now, that will narrow in coming months, but it's still a very large gap. And again, the problem is the virus is still out there circulating and potentially leading to mutations and variants that will cause us further problems down the road.
You know, of course, there are a great many Indian Americans and also a large India media presence in the world that is being monitored in this country. So Americans are seeing, you know, how this is playing out there, and the images are just gripping and appalling. We wish the best to them, obviously, but also hoping, as you said, Jim, that there's a kind of a galvanized global response to this.
Bob, I want to move our conversation west of India to the coast of Africa and the country of Somalia. This Saturday, May 1st, the president of Somalia, best known as Farmaajo, is expected to address both houses of the Somali parliament after a split vote between the houses on the constitutionality of his attempted extension of his term. Now, Somalia's prime minister does not support the proposed extension and has told Somalis to prepare for an election. What's going on, Bob?
Jim, it's worth noting, first of all, that this year, start of this year, marks 30 years since the disintegration, the utter disintegration of circumstances in Somalia, especially Mogadishu, over clan rivalries. And among other things that led to the famous attempted intervention of U.S. forces and the Black Hawk Down incident, in which U.S. special forces were killed in an attempt to apprehend a warlord in Somalia. And also the walking away from that situation by the U.S. and the international community and the devolution of Somalia into one of the world's longest and sort of most dysfunctional failed states for a long time. So there's been this painstaking process to get this back in gear. A major international presence, UN Security Council, has been heavily involved. The African Union is heavily involved. Also to sort of try to stop an Al-Qaeda affiliate known as Al-Shabaab from taking over a bigger swath of the country. So all these things were going on, and there was this effort to balance out a political solution. Now, the latest attempt was to try to set up a transition for new elections. The last ones were 2016, 2017, and President Farmaggio emerged from that as the leader. There was this agreement known as the September 17th Agreement, I believe, in which there were going to be some improvements to the system to increase participation, to try to build confidence. The Klan leaders were going to select delegates to electoral colleges, and they would in turn choose parliamentarians who would help to fill up seats in the lower house. And then both houses, the lower and upper houses of the Somali parliament, would select the president. But that agreement started breaking down last fall and into this year. There was an attempt to try to resolve some issues earlier this year. In February, things really started getting serious, and there was a bit of uncertainty. And then you started having clashes between Somali forces, which show loyalties to various clans. And so you had a trigger. The most recent trigger was the influx into the capital of units of the Somali National Army who were loyal to opposition politicians. They were upset by this announcement that there was going to be a two-year extension of power. So that's been walked back by President Farmaggio, and he made a national address saying such, and he's going to address this weekend the parliament to kind of lay out a plan for the country to move forward and to hopefully regain some aspects of this process known as the September 17th Agreement, Jim. But it's going to take, I think, a lot of cooling of heads and of tempers among the various elites in Somalia. It's going to take a steady hand by the international powers who've been part of this process. African Union, I believe, has a mediator who's going to be involved. We should also note there's a new U.S. envoy for the Horn of Africa who's been appointed, who has a hugely busy inbox already, not only the Somali political crisis, but what we've talked about previously in the crisis in Tigray in northern Ethiopia, and also a water dispute involving Sudan and Ethiopia. So a huge amount suddenly going on in the Horn of Africa, Jim. Somalia is again trying to put the pieces together of a political compromise.
Bob, can you tell us a little bit more about the outside powers and the role they're playing in Somalia? Who's really active and what are they trying to accomplish?
The African Union, for one thing, it's worth noting, had until recently something like 20,000 or so peacekeepers in Somalia, and they were playing an important role, including as a kind of a breach or a firewall against Al-Shabaab resurfacing. That was certainly the interest of U.S. forces, but U.S. forces started withdrawing at the end of the Trump administration. But the U.S. still remains very much interested in what's going on in Somalia. Again, not wanting it to reemerge as a failed state, certainly in a haven for terrorist groups. And then you have the UN Security Council, which approves these peacekeeping missions, and it has given its blessing to the African Union mission. And among the African Union, it should be noted that Ethiopia had a number of troops there. They have been drawing down recently as Ethiopia deals with its own domestic turmoil. But you have Kenya involved, you have Uganda involved, again, through the auspices of the African Union. Then you have the European Union, which, again, through international organizations, but also with its own representation. The European Union is very interested in seeing Somalia stabilize and sort of come out of its era of darkness. Again, I should say, Jim, the specter, in addition to wanting Somalia to emerge as a stable country, or relatively stable country, the specter of Al-Shabaab coming back is drawing a lot of concern. There was just another incident or an explosion this week in which 7 or 8 people were killed in Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab still has areas of control in parts of Somalia outside the capital. And there have been reports even that it, as its tentacles have spread to other parts of Africa, to affiliates such as in Mozambique. So there is this sort of re-emerging potential terrorism threat on top of everything else that is causing concern, and I think focusing attention on trying to get the Somali political players to kind of stick to their bargain.
Bottom line, Bob, do you think the bargain's going to stick?
The track record is so poor, but there is a sense that Somalis of all clans and persuasions are serious about trying to do the right thing here. So I would say there is very cautious optimism that coming out of this weekend's address in Parliament, the country will try to move forward, but they're going to need a lot of international guidance, persuasion, and so forth to make it happen.
So perhaps with a little luck and maybe some compromise, we could get a good outcome.
we're certainly looking for something more positive and something that can, again, further put the events of the past few decades further behind Somalis, Jim. But I want to talk about another situation, Jim, that involves a longstanding civil conflict, U.S. involvement, terrorism. And what I'm talking about, of course, is Afghanistan. This coming weekend is the sort of kickoff period to the U.S. drawdown in Afghanistan. President Biden has announced the U.S. is going to be fully withdrawn by 9/11, by the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in the U.S. Now, in addition to that drawdown beginning, just so happens in the week ahead is going to be the 10-year anniversary of a raid that occurred under the Obama administration that killed Osama bin Laden. So, Jim, can you give us an update on what to expect the beginning of this drawdown period to look like?
First thing I should point out, Bob, is that the drawdown has already begun, as best we can tell. Once the decision was made by the president, the Defense Department began implementing plans to rotate out equipment. What we're looking at happening ostensibly on May 1st is for the first troops to be removed. I expect this drawdown or withdrawal to be quick, methodical, and quiet. Quick in the sense that President Biden set September 11th as a deadline for removing all troops. That's about 4+ months. But there's some indication that the withdrawal of U.S. troops could be done as early as mid-July. I think this withdrawal is going to be methodical in the sense that the Pentagon is going to try to do it in a very orderly fashion. You're going to see a lot of equipment return back to the United States or bases around the world. Some of it will be handed over to the Afghans. And I think one of the big question marks that the administration still has to develop is what continued U.S. support for the Afghan government will look like. But you're already seeing the military wind down a large number of contracts it has with local service providers. And again, I think this withdrawal is going to be relatively quiet if the administration has its way, not a lot of fanfare as U.S. troops exit. The wild card in all this, of course, is the Taliban. What are they going to do? As you know, Bob, there have been standing Taliban threats to attack U.S. forces if they're not out of Afghanistan by May 1, which they won't be. So the question is, are the Taliban going to follow through on the threat? I should note that the Pentagon is taking the threat very seriously. The aircraft carrier Dwight D. Eisenhower has been in the region since February, and my understanding is going to stay on patrol. Six B-52 bombers have been dispatched to the Middle East in case they're needed. And the irony of doing a drawdown is that the U.S. is actually going to dispatch some additional 650 troops to Afghanistan to help provide security. And I should note that the U.S. Embassy in Kabul has already ordered non-essential embassy staff to leave the country. So this withdrawal is underway, and it's hard to see it being reversed by the administration. The big question, of course, is what comes after the U.S. departure? And here I would say the experts are divided. I will note that this month, General Frank McKenzie, the head of U.S. Central Command, said that the government in Kabul will certainly collapse without continued U.S. support, whereas Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, says he doesn't personally believe that the collapse of the government in Kabul is imminent. And I think that's really the big question. And it'll be interesting to see what contingency plans the Biden administration develops if the government in Kabul starts to totter.
Jim, well, it's certainly a new chapter for everyone who's kind of accustomed to the cycle of Afghan stories. I'm struck by one wild card you mentioned, and do the Afghan security forces and government have enough of a sort of vitality and enough of a writ to be able to enforce their will? We're not looking at, by all accounts, at a situation like when the Soviets pulled out at the end of the 80s. However, I am curious about the region, the countries in the region, whether they are prepping in any sort of special way, because they were dismayed when the U.S. stepped away, you know, 30-some years ago. At this time, do you have some sort of special consultations going on among the Pakistanis and the Iranians and the Russians and so forth?
Nothing formal that I've seen, Bob. Obviously, Afghanistan has neighbors that are greatly concerned about the direction that Afghanistan goes. Problem, of course, is that their interests or the interests of these outside powers don't necessarily align. And what we've seen over the past, I mean, obviously during the American period in Afghanistan, that you had the Pakistani government or parts of the Pakistani government offering refuge to the Taliban. It's no secret there that they have been using bases in Pakistan to attack U.S. forces, international forces, Afghan forces, and the like. The Iranians obviously have a great interest in what happens in Iran, given there's a significant Shia minority in Afghanistan that has been targeted in the past by the Taliban. And China, which shares a very small border border with Afghanistan has an interest. Obviously, we talk a lot about Xinjiang, a Muslim-dominated portion of China, and there's always been concern on the part of Beijing that what's happening in Afghanistan could spill over into Xinjiang. But it's not clear what that means for the Chinese in terms of actual practical steps to take. And again, I'll just sort of close by saying there's been a lot of talk that the international community will still be providing support for the government in Kabul, and the prospect of getting some of that support, some of that funding, will lead the Taliban not to do a repeat of what we saw in the early 1990s, that it will in some sense temper what the Taliban do should they come to power. But I think you got to put a big question mark on that. Could happen, but I wouldn't by any stretch of the imagination chalk it up as a certainty.
And I should mention, you know, we referenced the bin Laden raid anniversary. Not a huge al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan by many accounts, but there is a presence.
Certainly. And there's also an Islamic State presence. And this is the challenge for the Biden administration. And you would have to think that people in the Pentagon and on the NSC staff are spending a lot of time thinking through how do we make sure that the terrorism threat in Afghanistan does not grow? Because obviously, nobody wants to have a repeat of September 11th. But the challenge you face is twofold. One, that threat is metastasized. We just talked about Somalia. You mentioned Mozambique. We could go across North Africa. There are lots of groups that sort of are continuing on Osama bin Laden's jihad. And how do you deal with that? I mean, the second problem is to the extent you're worried about something originating in Afghanistan, how can you keep tabs on it if you don't have boots on the ground? I mean, a lot of following of terrorism organizations can be done remotely, satellites, and trying to intercept internet communications and the rest, but it really helps to have people there who can see what's happening. And obviously, when the United States leaves, it's going to have none of its own forces on the ground, at least publicly. But beyond that, you know, local Afghans who might have been inclined to provide information when the Americans are there may sort of clam up in the absence of U.S. forces being around. And how well will the Biden administration or successor administrations be able to monitor what is happening in Afghanistan? That's going to be, I think, a pretty heavy intelligence lift because nobody wants to see history repeated. And obviously, even if you had an attack that was much smaller than that, but was targeted against the United States or against U.S. troops or individuals around the world, for the Biden administration, that would be politically very painful.
So perhaps the end of a forever war for the United States, but for Afghanistan, it's a forever war that continues.
Well, I'm not sure it's an end of the forever war for the United States as well, precisely because the problem of radical Islamic extremism, al-Qaeda, Islamic State, isn't going away. It will remain. Bob, let's pivot to our audience figure of the week section. As always, members of our audience can vote on the figure of the week, or they can tweet us at CFR_org. This week, the audience selected Iran's Javad Zarif leaked. What can you tell us about this choice, Bob?
Jim, it's one of the more curious stories of the week, but it certainly has intensified and been carrying on and kind of building up in intensity since this leak occurred. Let's talk about the origin of it. Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, was said to be conducting an audio recording with some government think tank in Iran who was compiling an oral history of Iranian politics. And that was something that was he was assured was not going to air in any sort of current time frame. It was going to be done for posterity. And so perhaps because of those assurances, the foreign minister was being a bit more candid than he might otherwise have been. And so he said a number of things that, while they didn't surprise anybody who closely watches Iranian politics and sort of the divisions amongst the various power centers, it still came as a bit of a surprise. And again, raised questions about who was doing the leaking and how does such a thing, you know, sort of leak out from this type of setting. But let's talk a little bit about what was said. Zarif is heard to be talking about the interference of Iran's very powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in foreign policy. And he was talking about the now assassinated Quds Force commander Qasem Soleimani sort of making common cause with Russia to try to quash what became the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. That was one of the elements of surprise, by the way, was the degree to which, according to Zarif, the Russians were trying to actually head off the deal, try to prevent the deal from happening, even though at the end of the day, they were part of the deal. And Zarif talks about, you know, the power that the Revolutionary Guard hardcore has in Iran, that it's sort of, you know, in a way, its diplomacy is serving the sort of the armed might of the regime as opposed to vice versa. And one quote that he has says, quote, "We paid for the military field more than the military paid for us." And so it stirred a whole bunch of discussions within Iran. There was no sort of refutation that Zarif ever said this, but there was some people quashing, you know, any sort of talk of there being friction between the sides and parts of the Iranian government and so forth.
Bob, do we have a sense that the tumult over Zarif's remarks have any lasting impact? Are they going to play into the election? Or is this just sort of a curiosity because it gives us a glimpse into the divisions that exist and that we've known existed in the Iranian elite?
Really good question, Jim. And I think it gets at the heart of this. First of all, why are we getting a leak like this? What was behind this? Was it because Iran and the U.S. are starting to walk back into potential revival of the Iran nuclear deal, for example, with their talks in Vienna, which seemed to be proceeding gradually but moving forward? Was it because of the upcoming elections in Iran in mid-June, in which hardliners are hoping to gain over the so-called pragmatists that are represented by President Rouhani and Javad Zarif, for that matter? Now, there had been some talk of Zarif himself even running in the elections. It's not clear yet what the slate's going to be. So there's a lot of intrigue. Iranian politics, such as it is extremely opaque. And so I think this is only adding to that. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not any sort of movement emerges from the supreme leader in Iran, Khamenei, about whether he wants to get to the bottom of this, or whether he tries to put down the foreign minister in any capacity, whether it causes any sort of further change in the vetting of presidential candidates in such a way that there really are no choices but hardliners. All that is still to be determined, Jim.
I should just note, Bob, that we are just about 7 weeks out from the Iranian presidential election, which is set to be held on Friday, June 18th. So we'll see who gets to run in the election and who wins. But I think you're right that it's almost certainly going to be dominated by hardliners.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The UK sends a large naval flotilla to the Asia-Pacific region, and China takes over the presidency of the UN Security Council.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. As always, Zoe Collis did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Thanks, Anna. Thanks, Bethany. And our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.